Today is the 17th of July 2012. This is the Pioneers of the Fringe project. Today I'm interviewing Vince Stewart at his home.
Vince, what's your full name?
Vincent Joseph Stewart.
And your place and date of birth?
Belmore in 6 to the 4th, 31.
And you're married to?
I'm married to Beth Lusk, L-U-S-K. She's a Queenslander from Maryborough. And we've been married for 44 years, 45 nearly.
Do you have children?
We have four children. We have Bernadette. We have Therese. We have Damien. And we have Louise. I'm sorry, Louise was the second. Therese is the fourth. ranging from age of about 41 to about 37.
Now, you ran the shoe shop at Green Valley.
That's correct. It was called Green Valley Shoes because Green Valley was the place. Until we actually got established there, we didn't realise there were so many suburbs or so many schools. There were 11 schools in Green Valley, and it was an eye-opener. You've never seen so many dogs, so many bicycles, and so many children on a Saturday morning. People who went there had got their first home, first backyard. So the children had to have a pet, they had to have a bike, and the parents had to have more children. To the extent that my shop, I had no experience in shoes whatsoever. It was my brother Frank and our friend Dr. Bill Monaghan and friend Greg Gwynn that opened the hardware shop. And it was Bill Monaghan said to me, "Why didn't you come out and open a shop there?" And I said, "Well, I don't know anything about any shops. You know, I've worked in the railways for 18 years. And they said, "Well, what are you interested in?" I said, "Well, I'm interested in clothing." And they said, "Oh, well, there's a clothing shop opening and there's a milk bar already and there's a hamburger shop and everything else. So what did you do?" And I said, "Well, I know a fellow's in shoes, Brian Brackenridge. He works for Flint's, Flint's. It wasn't called Flint's then. He said I could go into shoes, perhaps. I know nothing about them, but I can learn." So I had a fortnight's hot training in Chester Hill with Brian Brackenridge in Leo Flint's shoe shop. It was a real experience. I'd never had the experience of working in a shop or buying or how shops were set out. Anyway, Brian gave me a good experience in a fortnight.
Just let's reflect on that. I know it's going back a while, but what did your training involve? What were you learning?
Just standing in the shop and people asking me for shoes, and you never ask them their size. You look at their feet and guess, and it's a matter of the now I can look at a person's foot and tell them what size they take, and you were told never to ask them their size.
Just why was that?
Well, you could always get the most expensive shoe out, and then they would say, "Oh no, that's not mine," or that's too dear for me. So you knew then that they weren't going that way. So you went back to a cheaper shoe, and if the shoe didn't fit, well, you could tell then that it had to be larger or smaller. But you didn't ask questions, you served them.
Who were supplying the shoes?
In those days, there were many agents. Dunlop's were probably the main supplier. And there were different suppliers. McMurtry's was another. And that's an interesting thing with McMurtry's. Because of all the children in Green Valley, these days, you look at the football matches on the TV and you see all the coloured football boots. There's orange ones and red ones and white ones and green ones. Well, with the football in Green Valley, there were so many teams. Each village had a football team, whether it be soccer or league or whatever it should be. And they all got very impressed by their own importance. And we all did, I suppose. And they decided that I could perhaps get green football boots made for them. So it was actually started in Green Valley. The coloured football boots started in Green Valley back in about 1964. And McMurtry's laughed, and the traveller Alan Smith was a traveller from McMurtry's, and he'd been in the army with my brother-in-law. And he said, oh, you know, it's not a good thing. You'd have to have 200 pair made. And well, you imagine 13 in a team and 200 pair, would you sell them? We did. We sold 200 pair of them. There were a couple of pairs left, which we kept as souvenirs. We haven't got them now, though. But everybody in all the football teams in Green Valley had green football boots. And you look at them now and say, well, who did anything like that? McMurtry's actually queried the order, 200 pairs of green football boots. They had to make them specially.
What colour was the green? What type of green?
It was an olive green, an olive or... yes, I'd say olive, but not a little bit brighter than olive.
That's a great piece of information, isn't it?
It is when you look at the footballers today, and they don't wear black football boots anymore.
What about the sand shoes? Because today, think of the, like, I mean, I know I've got about 13 pairs.
Well, May Graham only said the other night to me on the phone, can you remember the sand shoes? They were pastimes. They were unbleached calico, or canvas, I should say. Sunbeams were the white ones. They were $2 a pair. No, $3 a pair. The unbleached went from something like 17 and 11 or $1.79, I should say. And
let's just say that again so we get that. So
the unbleached went from about $1.79 a pair. The bleached ones were about $2 a pair. So we, Mo Graham reminded me that we had bays of sand shoes, not they were unboxed, and we had bays of them. We had the ones and the twos and the threes and fours. We had seven or eight bays full of unbleached sand shoes, and I think the dearest pair was about $2. We'd have 50 or 60 pair of each size in stock, and May said, do you remember Beth having to go to Dunlop's quite often and picking up more size 13s, ones and twos, because that was the quantity that was going so quickly. And when you look at that, when you have a child and you say, what size does a child take? In those days, you could say, well, it's five sizes on their age. So if they were seven, they were in size 12s. So you can imagine the number of children between seven and 10. There were enormous supply, enormous demand for cheap sand shoes.
I know, they weren't very warm in winter, I remember, playing netball.
Well, then they switched to Mr. Sneakers. Mr. Sneakers were elaborate. They were tartan finished and plain navy and a bit of orange trim on them. And they were a good quality sole, but they were an imported sand shoe. They were imported by Harry Jensen, who used to be the Lord Mayor of Sydney, or he was Mr. Sneakers. But his son-in-law at that stage... was the traveller, and we used to order anything up to 30 or 40 cartons of Mr. Sneakers and have them. We wouldn't take them out of the carton, we just turned the carton on its side, and the boxes were only the size of the shoe itself. They weren't elaborate boxes, they were tiny, compact boxes, and there were shoes everywhere. There were Mr. Sneakers everywhere. We had them stacked high on each other, the carton on carton out in the back room. And again, that was one of the big sellers, just ordinary old Mr. Sneakers. I don't see them these days. I don't know what's happened to them.
What about school shoes?
School shoes? That's an interesting point, because we bought a lot of school shoes from a company by the name of Koala. They were a Melbourne company. Clyde Johns was the sales rep, and the Madden was the salesman, or the traveller. And we used to buy such a big quantity of their shoes because they were a reasonably priced shoe. And I asked them to supply, if they would sponsor, shoe bags. So they said they would, and they supplied thousands of bags, but all of them on the outside had a koala and a decorated green bag with koala on it, with the result of one school teacher came to me and said, I've been wondering what on earth the children were saying. Then they said they got their shoes at the koala shop. And it was, they all referred to the shop as the koala shop because they got the koala on the bag outside. May Graham at that stage worked at a furnishing shop a couple of doors down, and she remarked that they'd say, look at the shoe bags going by. Everybody was carrying shoe bags, all with koala on, and it became known as the koala shop. We used to buy so many koala shoes, and koala, and it didn't matter what shoe you bought, you still got a koala bag to take home. We also, at Christmas time, printed our own coasters. And on the coasters, it had Proud in Green Valley, because early in the piece, Green Valley was the run down by the papers, probably politically so, that it was going to be a dreadful slum, and you know, the people weren't of the highest quality or the highest intelligence either. That's very false. And it's a matter of that I had a utility.
What colour was your ute?
It was a white utility, and on the back of it, on the back flap, I had Proud in Green Valley, Green Valley shoes, Proud in Green Valley, and we had that utility, or two or three utilities, all with that brand on, with that signature on, Proud in Green Valley, which gave the thumbs up to Green Valley.
You referenced Bobby Lim show earlier to me. To put it into a context.
The Methodist kindergarten, they had the Wesley kindergarten, who was my little son at that stage, Damien, went to, and we had TV ads appealing for help to the people of Green Valley to help them sponsor the kindergarten and their welfare centre that they were running there. And they had TV ads with little children, a bit scraggly, lovely clean feet coming down a slippery dip. Had, you know, they were perfectly normal children playing in a park, but they needed help. And that's when I put the Proud in Green Valley, because Green Valley was being run down. As I said earlier, we didn't realise there were so many villages in Green Valley. And there were 11 schools, so you can imagine
the kids.
That's right. But everything in Green Valley was planned. If there was a vacant block of land, you'd say, what's that? They'd say, well, that's going to be the Presbyterian Church. It's not built yet. And what's that? That's going to be the convent. Not built yet. But it was planned right to the precision. I notice these days that the Shell Garage is gone. There's a shopping block on it now, or an office block on it. How that happened, I don't know. And the rural bank that was put on the vacant block in our area was supposed to be part of a department store, but the rural bank got a grant of land there, and it's now, I don't know what it is now, but it's the bank has gone out naturally. State
I think
bank.
It's a cash and carry. Or
I don't know. State
cash
bank.
Cash converter. Yes. We'll get back to this, but I just want to get a context of your siblings and your political background, I suppose, and your brother's careers, and how that influenced you arriving at Green Valley. So who are your siblings? You had two brothers.
There were mother and dad, Margaret and Frank.
Sorry, let's get your father and mother's full names, and if you remember their date of birth and your mother's former name.
I can't remember their date of birth, but I know they're over 100 now. Margaret Donnellan married Frank Stewart, Patrick Francis Stewart. His parents were Irish, and they started calling him Paddy, so he immediately became Frank Stewart, because he wasn't going to be called Paddy by anyone. And Dad lived at Marrickville, Mother was born in Parks, and the McGurs McGurr was end up being Premier of the state, but they had a chemist shop in Parks. And my grandfather, John Donnellan, mother's father, had the bootmaker store in Parks. And there's always been an association between the McGurs and the Stewarts until Donnellan's for years. It's now past its time. But Dad worked in the railways. Mother had six children under the age of 10. I was the sixth, and things weren't the best because I was born in 31, and that had been the Depression. And we had an auntie Peg Donnellan, my grandfather's sister, and she loaned Mother, I think, £300 to buy a business in Lewisham, to the number 13 Victoria Street, Lewisham, which was a corner shop. It was run down, dark and dingy. So Mother worked in the shop and Dad worked in the railways, came home at night and worked in the shop. And probably 2 years later, she fell pregnant with Margaret. And that was the seventh child. Margaret now lives in Ballina, but the seventh child. So we ended up selling out of Lewisham and going to Belmore, to live back in the family home at Belmore, Charmer Street, Belmore, in which street my grandmother lived. Jack and Frank were both very good footballers and tennis players. Joan and Mary, both the same. Mary was a squash champion. She married Vince Toohey, who was the Australasian squash champion, John Cheadle and Toohey. Kevin worked in the railways, took an interest in politics because Dad was interested in politics. Frank was interested in politics too. Frank ended up won a pre-selection for the seat of Lang, which Danny Mulcahy held, but Danny died, and Frank took over the seat of Lang. He was then in opposition for about 20 years because Menzies was the Prime Minister. When Whitlam got in 72, Frank became Minister for Tourism and Recreation. He died in about 1979. Frank died at the age of 57. He was playing squash with his daughter up at the entrance. Kevin was chairman of Canterbury District Hospital. Again, very, very interested in politics and very good speaker. So was Frank, a good speaker. And hospital worked in the hospital. He got a good grounding in medical experience. And when the Labor government came in the state, Kevin became Minister for Health. He was criticised and he did a lot of good things. It was one of those things that the dentists weren't allowed, dental mechanics weren't allowed to make false teeth. And Kevin got it that the dental mechanics could make false teeth and opened up the industry, took the main thing away from the dentist, so they were a bit upset about it. He closed several hospitals. He had a great trouble with Bishop Muldoon over the North Shore when they closed the Martyr Hospital. But the truth behind that is that Kevin had offered the nuns at the Martyr Hospital a new hospital, I think it was at Seven Hills, including chapel and convent. And they said, what will the poor doctors do, having to go all that way to work when they're here in the North Shore? So they didn't take it. The nuns didn't go. But that was one of the things that was criticised because the nuns were kept out of, closing down Martyr and North Sydney.
Okay, so you talked about let's talk about how the interest in Green Valley and the shopping centre and the investing in that with your family connection and how that got you there.
Well, Frank and Bill and Greg opened the hardware shop. I opened the shoe shop. I was the last shop on the row. The rest of the shops hadn't been taken. But after that, the delicatessen came in, and the furniture shop came in, the dry cleaners came in, and the State Bank had taken a small shop in the area, in the block, until they built their new one.
Can we talk about what year this was?
About 1964. I can't remember exactly, but there were... Theo Carosis was the milk bar. Peter Savalas was the delicatessen. John Bland was the chemist.
The fruit shop?
The fruit shop of the Zayers.
The cake shop?
The cake shop was the Pattersons. a lot of these shops changed hands later on, but they were there for, I'd say everybody was there for about 10 years before they did anything about selling out or anything like that. Peter and Theo went back to Greece. Whether they've come back again, I don't know, but they were bright. They made their money here.
Was that the Oasis?
The Oasis, yes. That was Theo's Oasis. But I think Theo went back to Greece as a Mercedes salesman. I believe he had an agency for Mercedes.
Let's walk through the shops. Let's think of. So there's the Oasis at the front of Miller's Shops facing Cartwright Avenue. Yes. Can you recall what was there? Was there a. Yeah.
There was a
restaurant, a Chinese restaurant.
The Commonwealth Bank. Commonwealth Bank, hardware shop, Oasis. There might be a Chinese restaurant now. The bank might be a Chinese restaurant now. It had been redeveloped. Then the Chick Salon.
So it was there.
Chick Salon. It was ladies' lingerie and stockings and all that business. The counter from that chat in my back garage now, because I bought it when they closed down.
I'll have to photograph that.
So you can't photograph it.
So coming who into owned that?
Chick Salon. There was a chain of them, just like...
A franchise.
Not a franchise. It was a chain of Chick Salon, but all ladies' accessories. And Palmer's was the menswear. They were the City Palmer's from Park Street in Sydney. They had the shop out there. Barry Owens was the manager of that. We had Graham Poehler as the jeweller. Graham's now over the North Shore, over North Sydney in a jeweller's shop.
Now the supermarket.
We had, not Safeways, Safeways, yeah, Safeways. Safeways was the small one, and we had Woolworths was the big one. Woolworths and Safeways. I think when Woolworths built their new, when the new section came in, I think Franklin's came into Woolworths' old store. I think that's the setup there. We had a few odds and ends in shops come in and go out, like a model train thing or model car thing on tracks, and it lasted a little while. We had a fellow by the name of Wolston opened a disco with Go-Go Girls. We hadn't heard of Go-Go Girls, but it was a disco that was round the corner behind the Phillips's milk bar. Oasis was one end, Phillips was for the next, John Phillips. I think they're still there. I believe their son-in-law's running their shop now. And behind that, there was a vacant shop which Wolston took over as a go-go shop. We bought chairs and everything else, and I never went to it. I don't think it lasted more than a couple of months, but it was supposed to be Go-Go Girls. And it was only soft drinks. But, you know, then I read in the paper where Walton went into liquidation, or his firm went into liquidation, so I don't know what he was doing. But the owners of the arcade were Arcos Industries. And if you look around Sydney, the overhead wiring that goes from here to there and everywhere, all the big towers of wires, carrying wires across, they were Arcos Industries. They got the contract for that.
How do you spell that?
ARCOS.
So they own the shopping centre?
They built the shopping centre.
They built it?
They built it. And Mrs. Eisner, it was the Eisners, they were, I'm trying to think of his name, but Mrs. Eisner anyway, used to come round in a lovely mink coat.
Just to rub it in?
To check the place. But she was a lovely woman. And
describe her. How did she look?
She was a Jewish woman, and apparently Eisner was her cousin. He'd been married before, but she must have been probably 10, 15, 20 years younger than he.
What colour was the coat?
I'm trying to think of the correct name of the. It was the top mink. The top mink, it was a diamond mink and lovely brown, but She used to always be so well dressed and so very well spoken. And she took us to dinner one night at the American Club. We didn't realise why, but she wanted to get in touch with my brother Frank to see what he could do about it. They also had the Whitehall Hotel in Rushcutters Bay over White City. And it was a point that apparently there was a curfew on flying at night, and if the planes were delayed and they had to reallocate the passengers to hotels, she wanted Frank to allocate them to her hotel in White City, like billet them for the night, which means big business, because you get 100 people billeted for the night, you get good money. But she wanted Frank to do that. Frank wouldn't come to the dinner with me.
What was her full name?
I think it was Elizabeth. Elizabeth Eisner.
How old was she at that time?
She'd only been about 50.
And she'd come and walk through the shopping centre?
Yes, speak to everybody, speak to all the shopkeepers. She was liaison between the firm, and she would get paid for it. It was on the payroll. She'd probably get $1,000 a week to come out and have a look. It was a diamond mick.
That would have been amusing. And the contrast.
The contrast was there, yes, but she was never out of place. She was never out of place, always friendly, never argued with anyone, listened to everyone. They had great employees that would come out earlier in the piece and want to argue about the rent and argue about the way things were going, and we would argue with them. But Mrs. Eisner, you never argued with. You were always nice to her. She was always nice to you.
Now, the shopping centre itself, was it a cement floor?
It was a dirty cement floor that they painted green every so often. And I used to wash it down each morning outside my shop, but they had metal bins that were supposed to be flower pots or flower gardens, but they never put any soil in them, never put any shrubs in them at all. They were just big, dirty old, big, rusty bins, square bins on the end of each seat. The arcade was open, no doors on either end, and the wind would blow across from Miller High School. The dirt would blow, and it was an open field before the houses were built. It was absolutely filthy, and the block that hadn't been built on was even worse, because it was right at your front door, and the dust would blow everywhere. And as I said, dogs, bikes, children. One Saturday morning...
Heat.
Yes.
Cold.
But my shop was a success. Like, I had no experience. My shop was a success, and one of those things that I'm not over bright, but it was a natural for me, and to the extent that we had 20 chairs in the shop and you could not get a seat on a Saturday morning. There were people standing up waiting to be served. It was acknowledged in the industry that it was a top-notch business. It wasn't an expensive business for the people buying there, because I never bought any of the exclusive shoes. It was mainly basic, everyday footwear without a big price on it. I didn't stock Clarks or anyone like that, because they were too dear for the area, I thought. And I found alternatives in the shoes. And
Koala,
yes. Paddle was another one. But it was a matter of that I had the... On a Saturday morning, I had the Dunlop Traveller working... I had the Hole Proof Traveller working. I had...
When you say that, what do you mean?
They were casuals on a Saturday morning, came and worked on a Saturday morning, because the shop was so busy on a Saturday morning. We had seven salespeople in the shop on a Saturday morning. Seven. These days you see one in a department store. My shop on a Saturday morning had seven, and it was so crowded that one Saturday morning we served away, and then we looked around, the shop became empty, and there was a stroller in the corner with a baby in it, and we said, "Whose is that?" And some fella ran back in and said, "We left the baby," because there were so many in the shop, they forgot the baby, because you couldn't see the baby for people. But it wasn't a business that ever achieved great financial gain, because it was done on the very basic footwear. I know that one Saturday, or one day, one of the sales girls... sold $180 worth of shoes, and that was extra good because normally you'd buy three pairs of sand shoes for $6. And these days, one pair of sand shoes wouldn't, you wouldn't get another $10-$12 for a pair of shoes.
Did your salespeople look after brands? Did they say how you arranged?
No. They sold everything. But I had the Hullproof Traveller, the Dunlop Traveller.
What does that mean when you say that?
Well, they were the reps. They were the people selling me Dunlop's shoes and items. Hullproof were selling me the jiffies and anything we wanted in from Hullproof, which included underwear. So the staff were always, well, had good underwear because we used to always just get them discounted. The fashions that went, we had JC's, JC sandals. We used to call them Roman sandals, just out of respect. And we had the granny sandals. I can remember Mother Stewart from over at the convent, the old Irish nun, and she got with it. She got a pair of granny sandals. I think they were...
She lived in those.
$4.99, and the sole spit on them. And she brought them back to me to show me the solid split on the sandals. And I told her she was genuflecting too much. That's why they... But with the soles at that stage, there was something wrong with the mixtures. And if you went hot and cold, like if you walked on a hot floor or a hot floor and then walked onto a cold floor, it split the sole. And it was quite a common thing for these soles, especially... The Grosby stuff, the soles would split the girls in the cake shop. You'd sell them a new pair of shoes, they'd go across the cake shop, into the cool room, out of the cool room, into the cool room, out of the cool room, by the ovens and everything else, and their soles would split within a month or so, the soles on the shoes.
Now, you have your employee who was with you, who was going to be here today. Tell me how that happened.
Well, I had about three or four girls during the week.
What were their names, do you remember?
There was Beth Cross, I should say, and I had May Graham, I had June Fowler, I had the girl Casson, I had Rosemary Byrne. From the Byrnes family. Adrian Byrne. Yeah, well, his sister Rosemary.
June Fowler, why do I know that name?
Shropshire Street. And she had a daughter who was deaf and dumb. Robert was the husband. And they were just people came to me. I didn't go looking for staff. They came to me and I selected the ones I wanted, and Bev Cross was another one, and there was quite a number over the years.
So Beverly Cross...
Beth Cross. Yes.
Karen Cross's sister.
Yes. Mother.
Oh, the mother. Yes. That's right, yes. Up on Busby.
She's up at Constellation these days, or she was. And I had a lot of junior boys. Michael Earle was one. Robbie McGregor. I don't think it was Christian name. I've got a plaque outside that he did. Stephen Hunt. But they were all casuals, and they learnt to mix by being in the shop. Greg Bylider was another one. We had vision meters, and Greg used to carry, that was to measure the children's feet. And Greg, that was Greg's instrument. He'd walk out with the vision meter as though he was the expert on measuring feet, and that was his security. He'd do that, and he ended up being an engineer. But Stephen was in the police force. Michael was in the railways. But Robin McGinty went to the army. But it's a it's history to me now, definitely history.
Tell me how it would be driving into Green Valley at that time.
Well, early in the piece it was Belmore. I came from Belmore up the highway, up the Mulpera Road, and it was quite good. I used to, Greg Gwynn and myself used to travel to work together because we came from the same area. Greg was Campsie. But then later on, when I got married in 67, I went to, came down here to Stanmore Park, and used to take 30 minutes to the army camp from here, and then take another 10, 15 minutes from the army camp to Green Valley. It was a good trip. The Heathcote Road was just as heavily trafficked as it is these days, and it was a good flow through. On Saturday morning, I used to take my children to work with me. We'd leave here about 7 o'clock. Bernadette and Louise and Damien, Therese wasn't in that effort, but I'd take them out, and they would bring a couple of girlfriends with them. So we'd all go to work at Green Valley. They would have the time of their lives just walking around the shops in the shopping centre or doing what they wanted to, just something different to the ordinary going to school business. But they learned a lot. They learned a lot on the effort. I can remember one day I had Bernadette out there, and she came into the shopping centre, and she came back. She had a bundle of straws. She had a packet of biscuits. Forget what else she had, but the items came to about $4, $5. I said, "Where'd you get those?" And she said, "In Safeways." And she'd been through the checkout, gone into Safeways, picked up the things. She knew we had to get straws. She picked up a couple of other items as well, came back, and she'd shoplifted them, but quite correctly. She'd walked through the barrier, but no one had stopped her. So we took them back to the shop, and they said, "Oh, we didn't know. Another item that happened one day, the manager of Safeways came round and said to Mr. Graham, "We think the girl on the cash register is not ringing everything up. Would you come round and get a carton of cigarettes and give her the right money? It'll cost $15 to do, 10 or something like that, whatever the amount was, and just say you haven't got time to wait." And she went in and got the cigarettes and said, "Haven't got time to wait," and gave her the money and came back to the shop. And the manager came round and said, "We sacked her." She hadn't rung the money up. And May was most upset because she thought she was the nicest girl on the staff. She was the friendliest girl on the staff, and she got on the sack. She didn't tell her it was her that did it.
And you remember the flats there, all the flats that surrounded the shop. Were they all occupied?
Yeah, they were all occupied.
Oh, hang on. Yep, we're still... I just want to... Sorry.
They were all occupied, very friendly with the pensioners. I was the JP, and I would sign in the up to 10, 12, 13, 14 passports a month, and didn't matter how busy the shop was, they wanted their passport signed straight away. I would sign wills, witness wills, I should say, and in one case, a fellow by the name of Bob Craig, whose mother lived in the flats opposite. She would be in her late 80s or 90s, and she was apparently, who's the one on the banknote? Carolyn Chisholm. And she was apparently Carolyn Chisholm's auntie or niece or something such like that. But Bob was a Bob always had a cigarette in his mouth, and you had to work out what he wanted. But he wanted shoes for his mother, but she couldn't come out. He had to take the shoes to her. She was size 8, I remember, 8 straight. And I used to give him 4 or 5 pairs of shoes, and he'd go back and go, "Nom, nom, 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 nom," and he'd work out which ones he wanted, and you'd get the money. Later on, Bob, as far as I know, Bob never worked, but he was an artist. But I've never seen the art. but he had his art. I met him some years after I left Green Valley, and he cried on my shoulder that he was he'd given up the flat at Green Valley and had gone to a place over Fairfield. It was a backyard hut. They're all single men huts, and they were picking on him, and he wanted to get out. And at that stage, I was quite ready with the Christian Brothers here in Stanmore Park, and they had a little flat which they wanted for a caretaker, and the position was vacant. So I said to Bob, would you take it? And I said to Brother Dorn, would you let him in? So Bob came down here. Bob didn't caretake anything. He just did his art. He never mixed with anyone. He did join an art group down here. But he gave it away. He just left it. He gave away. It was, I think his rent here was $50 if he looked after the place and just caretaked it, gave the keys to the people coming in, because they have retreats and things like that. But he gave that away. He decided I was too much for him. But where he is these days, I don't know. But he's one of the lost causes of Greenville, one of my lost causes. I tried hard to get him into the circle down here. I got him into the church, or he was a Catholic, and practicing Catholic. And we brought him to functions in the home, had him here for Christmas dinners, but he just didn't click. Just didn't click.
How did you spell his last name?
C-R-A-I-G, Bob Craig, Carolyn Chisholm. Apparently he had a cousin who's a professor, and he lived over the North Shore. That's all I know about him. I didn't know what happened to his mother. His mother died, I know that, but it was after his mother died, and then when he was crying on my shoulder, he thought he might get married. And I spoke to someone in the flat that he had been in. They said, he's got no girlfriend, but he decided the way to get a new house was to marry someone with one.
What about the library and the post office? Was that there, across the road? The old post office?
That was
Barbara Kane and Margaret Taylor.
Also Reeves, Lois Reeves. She was from Fairfield. Lois was a hard case. Lois used to like me because I'd drive her home occasionally. She'd get me to take shoes to one of her girlfriends at the hotel, so she'd get a drive home. And I'd have to drive her home to Fairfield, and she'd stay at the pub with the shoes and come back the next day with the money for the shoes.
So is that the Green Valley Hotel?
No, Fairfield, over Fairfield. The Green Valley Hotel, Neville Bates had it. I don't know where Neville is these days. He was at that.
Central Coast, he is. He's just retired.
Has he?
I've got to interview him. He's my last one.
Hmm.
So when did the Green Valley Hotel, do you remember the Green Valley Hotel getting opening, or was that?
Yes, not so much the opening as going there. We didn't go there greatly. Ted Powell and myself used to go across and perhaps have a lunch there. We'd have lunch. John Bowers was the butcher, T.A. Fields, John and Thelma Bowers. They were parishioners at St. Trees. They're up north now, up at Queensland, I believe, Bob and Thelma. But the hotel, there was nothing great about it except Trixie Kennedy, her husband, Rube. Trixie was most upset because the hotel got robbed of $7,000, and Rube wasn't in it. They didn't let him know it was on. So she was most upset to think that Rube wasn't in the robbing the hotel. But Rube disappeared. There was some murder over in Drummoyne Way, and they suspected him. But we haven't seen or heard of Rube since. They were looking for Rube, but Rube probably changed his name and changed his identity completely. But don't know what's happened to him. But there were great times we had so many bad checks from people you did trust, bad checks. Could name the people, but I won't. But it's all the run of the business. You trust people and they don't come good.
Do was your connection to St. Therese Church of the parish?
Probably Father Muldoon. Father Muldoon had a brother who was Gemcraft, and they lived at Campsie. The Muldoons lived at Campsie. And that's a side story too that you said about the hotel. Muldoon used to get Greg to buy him a bottle of scotch and take it across because he didn't want to be seen in the hotel buying scotch. So Greg used to have to buy his scotch for him. And the Betty McMahon from the nuns and Mother Stewart. There was another nun, that May and Beth befriended. And they used to take it to the club for lunch, down at Canterbury Bankstown League Club for lunch. And at that stage, Beth was pregnant. And we had booked a table and said, now, one of the women is pregnant. So we didn't think it was the nun that was pregnant, because she was wearing a uniform as well. Trying to think of her name.
Belt or Dumphy or Cornwall, Fleur, Flippo.
I think, but she was great friends. She was great friends, and there were turnouts at the church that I went to. I think one your father was involved in. He was crucified one Easter, and I was supposed to sing a line when he was crucified. But they didn't tell me when it was to be done, and I didn't do it. I was there in the hall, but didn't sing the line. I practiced it and everything else. And your father's on the cross, and I'm supposed to be singing, and I didn't sing.
And
I think that, like, when they had raffles, they'd put the raffles in my shop and items like that. It was just a general connection with being a Catholic, and I should say practicing Catholic, and with the people of the church, because you knew who was what. Also, the nuns came to me and got me to put in grey stockings for the children at school, and put in hats for the children at school. I had to buy hats because by that stage Palmer's had gone, and I had to supply part of the uniform. I don't think we did ties, but they got me to buy things in that they could buy for the school uniforms.
Was there any other memories of other schools with special requests?
No. I was patron of Miller High with George Petrullio and I think Gough Whitlam.
What did that involve?
Very little. Just being friendly with the school and sponsoring a few things.
But you were acknowledged?
Acknowledged, yes. And that's because, I don't know why, but the pensioners grabbed me too. I had to go to all their functions. Admittedly, I had to perform at them. I had been a professional singer at the time. I had to perform at them, but I was always involved with the pensioners. I had to go to the pensioners, and at one pensioner dinner, Bernadette was probably about two, and Gough Whitlam was there with Margaret, and it was a Christmas outfit, and Gough had Bernadette sitting on his knee, and Bernadette took his pocket hanky out of his pocket and wiped her nose with it and put it back. So that's Bernadette's claim to fame. She wiped her nose on Gough Whitlam's hanky.
Was that useful knowing Gough? Because obviously he was our member for Werriwa, but was that useful with your connections with your family?
Having political connections, you didn't know what political connections did for you. But apparently I was friendly with Frank Oliveri and his wife. They used to get their shoes, the boys' shoes, they used to come to me to get them, and yet they had their interest in Liverpool.
But what sort of man was Frank Oliveri?
A very nice, pleasant fellow. Greg and myself went to his place one day because he had the Speedway in Green Valley. And he got us to sponsor a couple of the races, give a trophy for a couple of races. And we went up to his house, which he was renovating at the time, but he had one room with all trains in it. One room, and he had a complete train outfit in one room. So that was his hobby, trains.
What did you think of the buses, like Oliveri buses? Was there any comments on that around the shopping centre?
Yes,
around?
There was. We had great trouble getting the bus service. Went out a long way. It took all the streets going out of town, but came straight into town without picking anyone up. So they were taking the business to Liverpool and not returning the people to Green Valley, to the shopping centre. They took them out of Green Valley and didn't bring them back in. They brought them back the quickest way. But they stopped everywhere to take them out of town. And we had great trouble with that. They did alter the routes after some complaints. They said some of the streets we wanted them to go down, they said weren't built to take buses. That was their excuse. They weren't built to take heavy traffic. They were saying they went out on the heavy traffic roads.
And whose decisions were they?
They'd have been their own, the bus drivers, the bus owners' decisions.
And they were on council? He was on council, wasn't he?
Yes, he was on council, and that was again the council would have some control over it too. I know I wrote a letter to the leader, I think it was at that stage, and they didn't like it. It was complaining about the keeping Green Valley down, not giving the services to Green Valley, and they sent down about three or four aldermen to me to question me, or the Chamber of Commerce, I should say. The Chamber of Commerce came down and questioned me why I wrote the letter.
And who were some of those people?
I think Calabro. Can't think of the others. Calabro was one, I know that.
And what were they questioning you?
Just why I wrote the letter. What rights did I have to criticise them for?
That's interesting, isn't it?
Yes. But I didn't write the letter, Dad did.
Well, let's talk about your singing then.
Went to Mary's Cathedral in 1942. It was the first year that they had a choir school at St Mary's Cathedral. And I lived at Belmore, and you couldn't go past Marrickville because Marrickville was the first Catholic school that you could attend. But when I made it a choir school, it was a special request, so you could bypass Marrickville. I did go to Marrickville for a couple of years. And then, as I said, I'm not over bright, and they decided they'd send me to the cathedral and do the singing. Instead of being in the class of about two classes of 60, in St Mary's Cathedral was a class of 30, and it was better for my education, better for me to learn. And Mother and Dad were both singers, and I took up the challenge, and I was in the choir of the cathedral. The first year they had a choir, then... Naturally, I took lessons from Paula Clarkson, who used to coach a bit at the cathedral. Brother Carrig was the music teacher, the singing teacher. And after I left school, Paula used to train me. And then it wasn't until I was about 20, 21, I went into the Estedfords, the Sydney City Estedfords, and I won the junior or the under 21 baritone section, and that was against people like Bob Bickerstaff and the other ones. But they all ended up in Australian Opera, but I went on to be in the railway department because.
Why was that?
Well, it was just. I didn't have the ability for the music. I didn't have the ability to follow the music, the depth of the music. I could sing, but that was about it. And I then kept on singing and did a wedding at the Mary Elizabeth for someone. And the owners of the Mary Elizabeth of Kemba had heard me. And I was out at Jack's place at Carringbar building his house back in the 50s, and I got a phone call to go back to the Mary Elizabeth. They were short of a singer for a wedding at 12 o'clock, and so I had to whiz home and get dressed and go to the wedding at Mary Elizabeth and filled in for the singer that didn't arrive or wasn't coming. Then they offered me a job as a waiter at the Mary Elizabeth, just about when I was about 22, and I took the job waiting on the weddings, did that for a year or two, And the next thing I'm the singing waiter. And the next thing I'm the singer. And I was there for about 15 years. Millie Moore was the accompanist. She was the organist at Lakemba. She's the mother of Peter Moore, who was the Bulldogs president. Dad was the president before Peter. And I was at Mary Elizabeth for about 15, 16 years. And I retired when I was about 40, 41, something like that, because I had, by that stage, I had the four children and I had the businesses to look after. And we'd opened, by that stage, we'd closed Green Valley and we'd opened in Helensburg and Thrill.
Okay, so you left Green Valley and you closed because...
Because...
we'd all grown up.
Well, the rentals were increasing. Arcos had sold it. The rentals were increasing. The business was going down. And they'd built new shopping centres to Cashula and expanded Liverpool. And Green Valley became a second-rate shopping centre. And the rentals were so dear that it didn't matter. I put in if we weren't taking a certain amount by... When I signed the new lease, I put in if after 18 months we weren't taking a certain amount in our takings, I could stop the lease. And I did. We didn't take the amount that was required.
Can you talk about what rent you used to pay originally?
Can't remember much. It went from about 100 to about 350 to 400 a week over the years. And the business was going backwards, not forwards. It wasn't building up, it was going back. But it was up to about 350, it was 350, 400 a week.
And then you opened new shopping centres.
At Helensburg and then...
What were they called?
Green Valley Shoes.
Thrill.
No. Well, that's right. Oh,
I should have got...
That's Helensburg.
Oh, okay.
Where's...
Oh, there's Stewart's at Helensburg, yeah.
There's Stewart's at... No, there's...
Green Valley.
Yes, Stewart's is Green Valley.
Yeah, there it is. That's what I... Okay, so what else should we... What else... Now, can you make any comment about Father Muldoon's, like, other than the Scotch comment? Did he come and get his shoes from you? Do you... What sort of man?
No. I think I might have sent a pair across to him. There was a John Dickinson who was a student priest. He was ordained from there. I don't know where he is these days, but I gave him his shoes for his ordination. And I used to... the nuns, if they wanted anything like that, I'd give them. And in cases, some of the people that couldn't afford got shoes for nothing. But it's very hard to... Very hard to decide who's worthwhile giving to and who's not worthwhile giving to. Some people, you know, you look at them and think, do they need help or don't they need help? There's a lot of people. There were particular customers who were very hard to please. But I apparently got the name from one of the handicapped homes, the children's homes, with the handicapped children. And I had two or three... girls, that their mothers would bring them to me, and I was the only one allowed to serve them. They were mentally disabled, and two of them, their names were Julie. No, Kylie, I should say. But I used to have to get hugged and kissed and everything else just to serve them. But I was the only one allowed to serve them, and apparently it was that I looked after them and let them choose what they wanted. And didn't force them to do anything. The kids thought I was lovely. The mothers thought I was lovely. And it was when my first child was born, I cried because it was healthy. Just to have a child that was healthy, and you dealt with so many children that were disabled.
And that was particular to the area, was it?
They weren't from Green Valley. They were Liverpool and around the area. Apparently, got to the school where they went to, or the home they were in. And they used to bring them to me.
Yeah.
And I was the one to get them their shoes. the same here in Helensburg. I supplied Garawarra Hospital with the patients up there. I get kicked and sworn at, and I'd have to take talcum powder with me and rub it on my hands because there was fluid running down their legs, and they didn't like that. Parent gave me a kick, and it was interesting serving them at Garawarra Hospital.
And he must have seen a lot of prams in the shopping centre. Like on a Saturday morning, it must have been the hub of a meeting place.
It was.
Like it must have been so vibrant.
It was so busy on a Saturday that we used to just close the door, pick up the shoes off the floor, throw them behind the barriers so they couldn't see them from outside the shop. And one Saturday, I don't know why it was only a 12 o'clock closing those days, but one Saturday night I got a phone call to tell me the shop had been ransacked, and I said, no, that's the way we left it. And that's the way the business was. You're exhausted by the time 12 o'clock came, and just closed. I'd open at 8 and close at 12, but you're exhausted. You'd serve football boots until 9 o'clock because they're going to football and all want their football boots before they got there, and their sports shoes, so you had to supply them all with all those things. But we'd close the shop, go out the back and open a couple of bottles of beer, and all the women would drink too because it was the thing that was done. It just collapsed.
And what about Picker Prize? Do you remember that? Near the chemist there, near the fruit shop, the Catholics had set up Picker Prize.
I can remember it, but it didn't have much to do with it.
Yeah.
And they had their...
Well, you were too busy.
Well, that's right. And they had their... their regional radio, they tried to set that up there too. I don't know what happened to that. When these private broadcasters came in, there was the Green Valley Radio, but what happened to it, I don't know.
Actually did her history, Joan Killorn. Frank Scambry.
Oh, Frank did the wiring here. Peter was another one that I used to serve. Peter was one of the boys that I'd served and wasn't easy to serve. And I can remember one day he was in the shop and there was no back in the window, and Peter, there were plate glass shelves in the window, and Peter hit his head on one of the plate glass shelves because that's the way he charged everything, and I shouldn't have had the shelf there. I shouldn't have had because it hit Peter on the head. But Frank was a nice fellow. His wife was a lovely woman, and she died tragically.
What did she die of?
I don't know.
Yeah.
It was from one day to the other.
And so when you're thinking about, I don't know if we've got this recorded, when you're thinking about how the media portrayed the community and your experience of working with the community, how did that resonate with you?
Give me that again.
Oh, yeah, okay. So, you know, the media were bashing the community,
yes,
basically, in the press and... was the community, the way that the community was portrayed by the press?
That was early in the piece.
Yeah.
They laid off it after when a change of government comes, they lay off it. It's political. All that type of thing is political.
So what was the context then, politically? Who was running the state?
It was the Labor was running it, then the Liberals got in. I think that's the story. And then the Labor got back in again.
Liberal-controlled papers were
running down the Labor government, that's right. But the another person I must mention too is Darby Brown. I don't know Darby at all. Darby Brown was an Australian boxing champion, and he lived at Leslie Brown, his name was. He lived at Green Valley, and he was a rough-and-ready type of fellow. Apparently the trainers or his manager got the money and Darby got nothing. And he had a nice wife who was a hard-working woman, a little boy and a couple of girls. One of the girls was Leslie. And he used to be a great mate. And his wife died first, I know. I said, how's your wife? He came in one Friday. Said, the wife's ill. And I came on Monday, I said, how's your wife? And he said, oh, she's dead. And I couldn't stop, you know, I couldn't withdraw my question. Darby, one day, we had Ugg boots out the front, and Darby came up and brought me two Ugg boots. He said, there's a fella down the pub selling these. they'd take it off the table. Derby brought it back to me. Derby, you can trust Derby. But Derby took the Ugg boots off the fellow and brought them back to the shop. And the later on, the Commonwealth Police came. Apparently, he'd been cashing his daughter's, or his daughter had been cashing an unemployment cheque or a single mother's cheque, and she was married. She'd married again. They brought me the photographs. I used to cash the cheque for them. At times, I'd have more cheques in my deposits than I would have cash because the child endowment cheques were all sent to the person. And they'd come into me to cash their child endowment cheques, and I would do it for them.
Sound like you're a social worker.
You're about right. You're about right. Like a JP and cash their endowment cheques and everything else.
So you had a kind heart.
Probably. too kind at times.
You were just the right person.
Well, in that place, yes. At the right time, probably, because it's... It's memories, and as I said, I was with the pensioners, I was with the church, and with the schools.
God, they took full advantage of you, didn't they?
I'd say so.
What about the indigenous population? Because there was quite a big indigenous community. Very
good. Very good. Lovely.
And there was a lot of them, wasn't
yes,
there?
Yes. There was a girl. I think her name was Smith, the blonde. She had about 7 Aboriginal children. She'd adopted them. And she was Reg Quarterly's daughter. Uncle Reggie used to be on the radio. Uncle Reg Quarterly was on the radio. This is going back to the 40s. But his daughter, she was a blonde-headed girl, and she'd adopted these children or sponsored them, fostered them. And there was a Mrs. Stewart.
Yes, Scottish. And,
no, oh. Aboriginal.
Uh-huh, sorry.
And she had a...
We might say that again. I'll cut that out. So you told me there was a Mrs. Stewart.
A Mrs. Stewart, aboriginally. And she had a son that I saw in the Catholic Weekly only about 2 years ago, had won some art prize, and he's from Green Valley. Another woman, a lovely-looking woman. I don't know what her name was. And... I can't think of her name, I should say, but a most attractive Indigenous woman. And she's a lovely figure, lovely tall woman, lovely skin, but there were a lot of Aborigines in the area. It had no trouble with any of them, and not that you would. You have more trouble in the bush than you do in the suburbs. Not that you have more trouble with them than you do with anyone else either.
What about, so it was mainly Anglos, wasn't it, back then, was it?
Yes.
Because I have some history of a woman recalling, even when they were building the houses, that they were shooing away, like the Aboriginals must have been quite displaced, even then, you know.
No, I don't know that.
No, that's okay.
But the parties that I had no trouble with them, they were Mrs. German was one. There were the Germans. She was another Aborigine. Not you wouldn't know it, except for the cheques. And they used to, all the kids used to get their cheques too. The children used to get cheques.
So what were the cheques for?
For being Indigenous.
Compensation.
Yeah, being Indigenous. Being Indigenous. It was only a matter of $2 or $3, but this was 20 years ago. $2 or $3, which is 10-15 now.
Let's just focus on those cheques for a minute. What sort of cheques there were that you're getting?
There were the child endowment cheques, probably an unemployment cheque. There was the Indigenous cheque.
What about the police? Did you have much to do with the local police?
Only in friendship.
And who were some of those local police?
I can't think of their names.
Freddie Whitten, do you remember?
Can't say though. There was, in actual fact, we employed an ex-policeman to be a security man on a weekend. There, he was one of our mates from Belmore, and he was a retired detective, and we got him to walk around the arcade on a Saturday just to keep check on things. But then he knew the police, so the police knew him, but the the police station wasn't across the road then. It seems to cross the road now.
It's that little wooden one they burnt down.
Yes, yes. That's all they had. I think they had. I think they did build a station there, though, didn't they?
Yes.
Yeah. But that's. But the people generally were all decent people, and well, naturally they're all decent people. But you had your odd bods. You had your odd bods. And I think it was one weekend the shop was broken into. They went through the ceiling. Outside the windows were box windows, and they got up, went through the ceiling. It was a kid did it because. I know who did it. The little boy German did it. It was only silver in the till, 20-cent pieces, and he dropped the 20-cent pieces as he got, you know, when he came back through the shop. We knew who did it.
All right. So, are we nearly there? Do you think?
I think so. I can't think of anything else exciting.
You've said a bit.
I can't think of a great deal more, except that when I've been out there in the last year or so, the centre, I'd never take a shop there now, never. They're all disposal stores, and this was the management that they put in. They employ the management to control shopping centres. They wouldn't allow some shops in, the ones that got there now, that have never let them in years ago, never let them in. They're just bargain shops, hopeless.
So we're just going to check the dates of birth of your parents.
Margaret Mary Donellan, date of birth, 13th of the 6th, 1894, and she died on the 30th of the 6th, 1981. Dad was born on the 8th of May, 1894, and he died on the 16th of March, 1970. And they were married on the 6th of the 12th, 1919. There was another thing with the family and politics. I said there was Jack and Frank, Joan and Mary, Kevin and myself, and then Margaret. For them to get into politics, we all had to take some part. Joan and Mary and were in the sporting field. I was in the musical field. Kevin was in the hospital field. And Margaret was all political. Margaret's more political now than ever. And we all, in somewhere or another, you couldn't get away from a Stuart in Belmore because we were all in different fields. So any, like Frank and Kevin were the politicians, but the family were the backers. The family, you had to know a Stuart. You couldn't not know one because they were in the sporting fields, they were in the musical fields, and they were in the hospital fields. So it's a family effort, someone to get in politics. It's not just an individual. Well, it was with our family anyway. Dad was president of the football club. Kevin was president of the football club. Jack was president of Cronulla Sutherland Football Club, Carrinbar. So we're in the sporting field and in the life of the family.
Now, McGurr Park in Green Valley, that's not named
after that. Probably about McGurr, who was the Premier. Mm. Probably because of the Premier. That would be the story of that. He was the next Premier of New South Wales. That would be back in the 40s he was Premier.
Did you have that much to do with the Mayor? Whoever that was. Was that George Pacciullo?
George Pacciullo.
And he was a friend of yours?
No, not really. I knew of him, and his wife was a tennis player. And that's another thing, like we knew her from tennis, with our family playing tennis. And Jack Martin, my brother-in-law, was the president of the Catholic Tennis Association. And Vince Toohey was the state squash player. And, as I said, you couldn't get away from the Stuarts or their in-laws. That woman, when I said she was... Miss Judge, she was Anthony Horden's ladies' department, and she was retired, and she came out and helped me for a few months to taught me how to stack the shelves, how they run in colour order and size order. And as I said, that was me in a suit, and gave away the suit because you couldn't climb a ladder with the coat on and the shirt your shirt to pull out. So I ended up being with Jack's shirts and shorts, so the shirt was always out. And John Prue and his children there, they were customers. And as I said earlier in the piece, those chairs came from Canterbury Bank St Lee's Club.
Well, where did they come from?
Canterbury Bank St Lee's Club. They got new chairs and I got the old ones.
And who's the other woman in the photograph?
That's Beth Cross.
How old are you at the back there?
I'd have only been about 32, 33. 32, that'd be early in the piece because Mrs. Judge was only with me for a couple of months.
So what year, about 64?
About 63, 64.
So the shop opened pretty sort of soon.
The shed had been opened, but I was probably coming a month or two after it was opened.